They didn't hunt ghosts. They hunted grief. Today, we're taking a deep dive into the fascinating and, frankly, pretty disturbing case of the Phantom Recovery Unit. This was an organization that popped up back in the late 1970s. And this story, it's drawn from a really compelling stack of sources you've shared with us. Initial accounts, later investigative records. It's not just about a scam, is it? It feels more like a masterclass in psychological manipulation built on, well, the rawest human emotion there is.
Absolutely. Our mission today, really, is to unpack the legend of the PRU.
Mm-hmm.
We need to set it against what these documents actually show us. We'll be looking at how this group meticulously exploited one of humanity's deepest vulnerabilities, that intense pain of loss,
yeah,
and how that exploitation allowed this whole myth to be constructed and then somehow endure even after the facts came out. So we're essentially sifting through layers here, public perception on one side, documented reality on the other, to get at the true impact and, I suppose, the insidious genius of this whole operation.
Right. Get ready, because this journey is going to take us through their really elaborate theatrical methods. We'll explore the mystery of how they just vanished so quickly and reveal the haunting marks they left behind, both physical marks and psychological ones, too. This deep dive, I think it's really going to illuminate how easily those lines can blur between performance and, well, predation, and how persistent folklore can become when it's rooted in something as universal as grief. Okay, let's unpack this then. Our journey into the shadowy world of the PRU really begins precisely in 1976, and it starts with this figure named Leonard Price. Our sources describe him as the, well, audacious founder of the Phantom Recovery Unit, an entity he set up with this singular, almost brazen purpose, offering what he actually called fee-based purges of spirits. I mean, just imagine the sheer audacity of that proposition, to formalize and commercialize a service rooted in something so intangible, so personal, and, you know, so universally feared. It was a business model built entirely on belief, or maybe more accurately, on desperate hope.
Yeah, what's immediately fascinating here, looking at the methodology, is the calculated way they commercialized grief itself. The PRU didn't just, you know, appear out of thin air. It very deliberately positioned itself as a solution to that timeless human dilemma. How do we cope with profound loss? And what do we do with this pervasive, often ancient idea of restless spirits or lingering spirits? It taps right into these deep-seated beliefs, these anxieties that have existed across cultures for, well, millennia, all surrounding death, the unknown, the fates of loved ones. They weren't just selling a service. They were selling a kind of pseudo-spiritual fix for profound emotional pain. They understood that where there's a vacuum of understanding and intense suffering, people will often pay almost anything, exorbitant sums, for any narrative that promises control or resolution or just some peace.
And their core claim, it went even further than just saying, we'll purge the spirits. Price and his unit didn't just promise to cleanse a home of unwanted presences. They explicitly claimed they could free spirits from being trapped by grief. They framed the family's own sorrow, their natural grieving, as the very anchor holding their loved one here. Just think about the immense emotional leverage in that statement. They weren't just saying your house is haunted. They were telling grieving families that their own natural, profound sorrow was literally imprisoning their departed loved ones, creating this almost unfathomable burden of guilt. It put the responsibility, and so the perceived solution, right onto the bereaved, implying their feelings were the problem and only the PRU held the key to, well, absolution and release. So who were these people? The individuals recruited to carry out this really elaborate scheme. Our sources describe the PRU's recruitment strategy as remarkably cold, calculated even. They targeted ex-cons and drifters. And this wasn't random at all. It seems very strategic. These were men, as one source just puts it starkly, no one would miss if something went wrong. That allowed the organization to cultivate this workforce that was, well, disposable, but also inherently intimidating. It brought a certain rough edge to their operations, which probably underscored their unofficial yet somehow authoritative presence. It also gave the PRU a degree of plausible deniability, didn't it? Reducing the risk if operatives got caught or just disappeared.
And the visual appearance of these recruits, that was absolutely crucial. A key element of their broader psychological strategy, they were uniformly clad in black jumpsuits. Stark contrast, with these white chest patches emblazoned with what the sources call a crude image of a skull with a line through it. This skull with a slash emblem, it wasn't just a logo. It was powerful, simple branding, designed for immediate communication. It projected a sense of officialdom, almost paramilitary, you know, while also implying this definitive, almost confrontational authority over death or the spectral realm. So the choice of uniform combined with the personnel they chose, it really speaks to a calculated effort. Create an intimidating force, yes, but also an expendable one, one designed to look legitimate and powerful while operating completely outside any real institutional oversight or legal bounds.
You can just imagine the psychological impact, that uniform, the intimidating demeanor of these individuals, what that would do to people already so vulnerable. Picture a family completely lost in grief after losing someone, maybe just the days before, and then suddenly they're confronted by these grim figures, the stark black jumpsuits, that chilling skull emblem, the air of authority they apparently projected. It feels like it was designed to amplify their dread and underscore the perceived necessity of the PRU stepping in. It wasn't just about the services they offered, it was the entire meticulously crafted presentation. Blurring the lines between reality and the manufactured theatrics they were using, this was an organization that really understood how to command attention, how to instill fear, or at least a powerful sense of awe in those least equipped to resist. And beyond the personnel and their striking look, the PRU's operation was built on this elaborate system of, well, what the sources seem to call gear theater. They use these things described as scanners cobbled together from CB radios. Simple devices, right? Modified to flash and hum. Made to look like they were detecting unseen presences in a home. Convincingly, apparently. Then, to really heighten the drama, they deployed these peculiar tanks that spewed colored smoke, creating this atmospheric, almost otherworldly haze during their supposed purges. And to complete that illusion of scientific authority, high-stakes operations, they used what looked like standard steel cases marked with radiation symbols, implying dangerous, powerful substances were involved, enhancing the mystique, the perceived power of their work. It was a whole array of props, each chosen for impact.
Precisely. This entire gear theater was, as our sources confirm, all an act, meticulously designed to project an image. Official authority, scientific rigor, even though it was entirely fabricated, made from, you know, rudimentary components. The truly well-depraved brilliance of their method lay in their understanding. They knew that for people deep in grief, desperate for answers, the appearance of advanced technology and a structured process could be just as convincing, maybe even more so, than actual proof. This is such a crucial element of their whole performance versus proof strategy. They didn't need to actually do anything supernatural. They just needed to appear to be conducting a complex, effective, official intervention. The visual spectacle gave a tangible form to an intangible problem, offering this comforting, though utterly false, sense of control and action to people who felt profoundly helpless. The flashing lights and humming sounds of the scanners simulating detection, the colored smoke evoking mystery, transformation, the radiation symbols conjuring powerful unseen forces being managed, all of it carefully choreographed to manipulate perception and belief.
That's a really powerful observation, and you have to wonder, how did these relatively simple elements, a modified radio, some theatrical smoke, a few cases with symbols slapped on, create such a profound illusion? Especially for people who are utterly desperate for answers. It played directly into public perception, didn't it? Lending this almost undeniable credibility to their fantastical claims, right at moments of intense vulnerability. When rationality often takes a backseat to hope, or fear, or just that desperate need for closure, these props offered a concrete, albeit totally fake, explanation and a seemingly effective solution. The theatrics transformed what was, at its core, just fraud into something that looked legitimate, maybe even vital, giving people permission to believe something extraordinary was happening to fix their deepest pain. Okay, so we understand their setup, this calculated performance. Let's turn now to their targets. The PRU didn't just cast a wide net, did they? They meticulously focused on a very specific group, families who had just buried someone. This wasn't random, it was a deliberate and frankly, profoundly cruel strategy designed to prey on individuals at their absolute lowest. Right in the immediate aftermath of a destabilizing trauma, our sources keep highlighting this. Desperation made people believe, underscoring that profound vulnerability that let the PRU operate seemingly unchecked. They understood, with chilling precision, how raw, immediate grief could cloud judgment, erode skepticism, create fertile ground for exploitation like almost nothing else.
And this specific targeting, it really raises a critical question about how belief systems can be weaponized so effectively, so devastatingly. The narrative the PRU spun was truly insidious, designed to deepen existing pain, not alleviate it. They tell these grieving families that the deceased were restless, trapped by grief, and chillingly that the family's own sorrow was an invitation for spirits to linger. This manipulation hinged on taking a universal, natural human emotion, mourning, and twisting it. Twisting it into a purported danger, a trap for the departed. They weren't just offering to clear a house, they were offering to free a loved one from the very emotional bonds the family felt. Preying on guilt, promising a path to alleviate it. They essentially intended a problem rooted in existing profound emotional pain, then sold a costly solution. exploiting that universal desire for closure, for peace for the departed. It's a classic cruel example. Create a deep wound, then offer a fraudulent self.
And for this twisted kind of peace, this absolution, the PRU offered a suite of services, just as theatrical as they were exploitative. These involved meticulously orchestrated midnight rituals and highly effective staged hauntings. Experiences designed to be deeply immersive, terrifying, and ultimately convincing. And of course, every step of this elaborate performance came with large payments, often running into thousands of dollars, extorted from families already struggling, immense emotional strain, often financial strain too. Imagine the emotional roller coaster, the terror of the supposed haunting, the flicker of hope for resolution, then that profound but false sense of relief, all meticulously engineered. Then wrapped up in a transaction that left people financially drained, emotionally manipulated, often without ever realizing they were victims of this grand deception. They weren't just paying for a service. They were paying for a meticulously choreographed experience designed to confirm their deepest fears and then promise to take them away. Let's really try to picture the scene for a moment. The cleansing act itself, piecing it together from the sources. Imagine the dead of night, the black-suited figures of the PRU, those skull emblems stark against the dark fabric, moving through a bereaved family's home, the air thick with unspoken dread, the flashing lights of their makeshift scanners, remember, cobbled from CB radios, sweeping the rooms, almost rhythmically, suggesting a hunt for unseen, malevolent entities, intensifying the atmosphere. Then, at the supposed climax, the dramatic release of that colored smoke from their special tanks, billowing, swirling through the air, creating this deeply immersive, unsettling experience, a visual representation of the intangible being expelled. It was all meticulously orchestrated, every sound, every visual cue, designed to build tension and terror, culminating in this profound but entirely false sense of catharsis, giving the impression that something monumental, something truly spiritual was happening, that the suffering was finally over.
And this entire operation, it was exquisitely designed to capitalize on that human emotional susceptibility. It's a textbook illustration of the performance versus proof dynamic we talked about. The PRU masterfully offered a tangible, albeit completely fraudulent, resolution to intangible, deeply personal suffering. For individuals overwhelmed by the disorientation of grief, feeling utterly helpless against death and the unknown, the PRU provided a powerful, if temporary, illusion of control. The theatrical display wasn't just for show, it was the product. It created a powerful, though ultimately false, belief that the problem, the lingering spirit, the burden of their own grief had been identified, confronted, and then miraculously resolved. This elaborate charade offered a potent psychological balm, a moment of desperately needed respite from unbearable sorrow, but at a truly terrible and enduring price, both monetary and emotional.
You're absolutely right. And it wasn't just the financial cost that was so devastating, though thousands of dollars from vulnerable families is certainly significant. These families weren't just robbed of money. They were potentially robbed of a healthy, authentic grieving process too. The PRU didn't just take their funds. They actively interfered with a deeply personal, necessary emotional journey. By creating this false narrative around the loved one's lingering spirit and the theatrical cleansing, they could have inadvertently prevented true acceptance, healthy emotional processing, maybe trapping families in a prolonged cycle of fear, guilt, and false hope. The emotional toll of realizing you'd been so profoundly misled after opening yourself up during such a vulnerable time, it must have been immeasurable, extending the trauma far beyond the initial scam. So for nearly 4 years, right, 1976 to 1980, the Phantom Recovery Unit operated with this shocking level of impunity, preying on the most vulnerable. Their reign of emotional terror, though, it couldn't last forever. Enter Diana Kersey, an intrepid investigative reporter who dared to expose the PRU. Her initiative, her sheer ingenuity, her profound bravery in taking on such a shadowy, secretive, potentially dangerous organization, it's truly remarkable. She didn't just report from a distance from the safety of a newsroom. She went right into the heart of their deception, a decision that would ultimately dismantle their entire operation.
Her chosen method of infiltration was absolutely crucial. She needed irrefutable evidence to crack an organization this elusive. Our sources vividly describe her posing as a grieving widow, adopting the very identity of the PRU's prime target. The critical piece of her strategy, though, was carrying a hidden tape recorder in her purse. This wasn't just courage, it was profound journalistic integrity, strategic foresight. Without that kind of first-hand, documented, audio-taped proof, the voices, the threats, the manipulative language captured live, the PRU's claims would have been far easier to dismiss. Just hearsay, disgruntled accusations. Her commitment to documenting the truth, even at considerable personal risk, provided the concrete, undeniable evidence needed to pierce their elaborate veil of performance.
Absolutely. The necessity of her undercover work, you just can't overstate it, especially with a group like the PRU. To really penetrate something so secretive, so psychologically manipulative, so exploitative, you had to become part of the narrative they spun. Kersey immersed herself in the very vulnerability the PRU cynically capitalized on. It allowed her to witness these staged hauntings, the midnight rituals firsthand, to experience the emotional manipulation from the inside, and most importantly, to capture the specific threats, the insidious fear-mongering language on tape. It was really the only viable way to move beyond rumors and present the unvarnished, undeniable truth to the public, offering a crucial lifeline, really, to countless other potential victims who might otherwise have fallen prey. Okay, so here's where it gets really interesting. Explosive, frankly. When Diana Kersey's meticulously researched story finally aired in 1980, the impact was immediate, widespread, devastating for the PRU. Her expose exposed everything. The calculated threats, the meticulously staged hauntings, the thousands in stolen money, the entire fraudulent operation laid bare. You can almost feel the collective outrage, the sense of betrayal that must have rippled through those communities they targeted. The carefully constructed facade of the Phantom Recovery Unit, built on fear and desperation, it just shattered under the weight of her evidence, revealing the cruel predation beneath the theatrics.
What's truly fascinating here, and quite telling about the nature of this organization, is the speed and thoroughness of their disappearance. Right after the story broke, almost like magic, or maybe more likely, meticulously pre-planned protocol, the Phantom Recovery Unit vanished overnight. Our sources note their Detroit headquarters, once presumably busy with clandestine activity, was stripped to the walls. Absolutely no trace left. Operations personnel gone. This complete and rapid erasure. It's almost as if they were designed to be ephemeral from the start. Suggests a highly organized group, acutely prepared to pull the plug at a moment's notice. No paper trail, no physical evidence linking them. Hinting at a sophistication far beyond just a fly-by-night scam. It almost mirrors cases like Klaus Richter, doesn't it? Where the erasure itself becomes the most profound evidence, telling us more about their capabilities than any recovered document. The absence of evidence is the evidence of their strategic genius and self-preservation.
But here's the kicker. The truly unsettling detail that underscores their elusiveness elevates their story from just a scam to this persistent urban legend. Despite Diana Kersey's explosive expose, despite the clear, documented evidence of widespread fraud and exploitation, not one arrest was ever made. Just think about that for a moment. An entire organization methodically preying on the grief-stricken, exposed in a massive scale, yet no one was ever brought to justice. It's a stark, almost unbelievable contrast to the vivid details of their operation and their swift, almost supernatural exit. This complete lack of legal consequence really makes you wonder, doesn't it, about the full extent of their network, their influence, or perhaps just the sheer perfection of their disappearing act.
The implications of no arrests are indeed profound, deeply disturbing. It strongly suggests a highly organized group capable not just of operational secrecy, but complete self-preservation and evasion at the highest level. They weren't only incredibly effective at exploiting their victims' profound emotional pain, they were remarkably adept at disappearing without a trace, leaving this vacuum where justice should have been. This left their victims with no official recourse, no legal closure, no satisfaction that their tormentors faced accountability. This lack of accountability allowed them to just melt back into the shadows, leaving behind only the trauma of their victims and these unsettling questions about how they managed such a clean getaway. It paints a chilling picture. An organization designed from inception to be untraceable, a phantom in every sense, successfully eluding the long arm of the law.
So the Phantom Recovery Unit vanished. No arrests. And yet, their story doesn't just end there, does it? It doesn't just fade into forgotten history. We move now from the organizational disappearance to something more tangible, almost ghostly, a mark they left behind. Our sources confirm that in old neighborhoods across Michigan and Ohio, even today, you can still find the mark they left behind. This isn't just folklore, it's physical evidence of their presence, a lingering echo of their reign that persists decades later, a silent testament to lives they irrevocably touched.
And this specific mark, it's described as a white skull painted on door frames, often found almost hidden under layers of peeling paint. This physical artifact serves as a silent yet potent testament to their presence, their past operations. It's an incredibly chilling detail, isn't it? A faded symbol, a brand, left on the very threshold of the homes they invaded, emotionally, financially. It acts as this somber, subtle scar on the collective memory of these communities, a physical link connecting the historical record of their existence to the present-day landscape. That skull sigil, though obscured by time and paint, it continues to evoke that sense of malevolent authority they cultivated, a whisper from the past.
So, what does this all mean? How does a fading, almost obliterated symbol on a doorframe continue to tell such a visceral story decades later? It's more than just old paint. It's a subtle, almost ghostly reminder of their reign of emotional terror, a quiet yet profound testament to the enduring impact of their actions, a physical manifestation of a psychological wound inflicted on communities. This specific, concrete detail roots their story firmly in the tangible world, preventing it from completely fading into pure myth, even if the organization itself is long gone. It's a persistent, unsettling memory etched right into the architecture of these places. And beyond these specific physical marks, there's the enduring urban legend associated with the PRU, a whisper that refuses to be silenced by mere facts. Despite the documented disappearance, the complete lack of arrests, a chilling whisper persists in certain communities, a phrase that feels less like a historical anecdote and more like a living threat. And some say if you mourn loudly enough, they still come. That phrase itself is such a potent image, a spectral warning woven into the fabric of local consciousness, refusing to be dislodged by official records. It speaks to a deep, primal fear that their predatory practices tapped into the idea that grief itself could be an invitation for exploitation.
This raises a profoundly important question, especially for understanding how narratives work. Why does the legend seemingly outlive the official record? Even with Diana Kersey's meticulous expose, which laid out the facts of the fraud, the emotional resonance of the PRU's claims, their methods, appears to have imprinted itself indelibly onto local folklore. It's really a testament to the power of a deeply compelling, emotionally charged narrative, especially one exploiting such profound human vulnerability, like we see in cases like Real Wendy, where official records can freeze a moment in time, but lived experiences, interpretations, they keep moving, evolving. The PRU's story has transcended being just a historical event. It's become a powerful, enduring, cautionary tale, whispered across generations, fueled, I think, by the lingering unease that often comes with unresolved injustice, unpunished predation.
It's a truly fascinating comparison, isn't it? On one hand, the factual record, an organization founded, operated, exposed by brave journalism, then vanished. No trace, no legal consequences, cold, hard data. And on the other, this chilling, persistent folklore suggesting their influence still hovers, a shadow tied inextricably to the universal experience of grief. The absence of arrests almost certainly contributes, right? Allowing the legend to fill that void where justice and accountability should be. It's as if, without a clear, definitive end, without the satisfaction of justice served, the story is perpetually doomed to repeat itself in the collective imagination, a warning continually reimagined.
And this phenomenon connects directly to the timeless, universal power of grief itself. The vulnerability the PRU so cynically exploited, it is timeless. It's an intrinsic human experience, transcends specific times or places. It speaks to our deep-seated need for ritual, for meaning, for control in the face of uncontrollable loss. Perhaps that's why the legend remains so potent, so persistent. A cautionary tale whispered through generations, serving as a chilling reminder that some predators don't just hunt for money. They hunt for the rawest, most exposed, most sacred parts of the human spirit. The profound fear they instilled, the pain they manipulated, ensures their story, however embellished by time, continues to resonate in the darkest corners of our collective imagination.
We've taken a really deep dive into the Phantom Recovery Unit today, an organization that masterfully exploited the rawest human emotion, grief, using theatrical flair and cunning evasion. We've traced the insidious myth they built, dissected the calculated methods they employed, and followed the courageous investigative journalism that brought them to light, only for them to vanish without a trace, leaving behind this unsettling, indelible legacy.
The PRU serves as such a potent reminder how deeply fear and sorrow can intertwine, and how readily performance can be mistaken for undeniable proof when individuals are at their most vulnerable. The official record tells us they disappeared, vanished into thin air. But the stories, whispered in old neighborhoods, and those subtle fading marks on doorframes, they suggest something far more lingering. A cautionary tale etched into collective memory that continues to haunt us.
So this deep dive leaves us with an enduring question. A thought maybe to carry with you long after our conversation ends. If you mourn loudly enough, they still come. Or perhaps. Perhaps it's just the chilling echo of a door marked with a fading skull. A ghost of a scam that refuses to fully disappear.